morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Scott Edwards. I represent the appellant Wedbush. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is a statutory construction case. The issue here is the proper construction of the term customer location. Wedbush construes customer location according to its ordinary meaning, where the customer is located. Seattle adds an extra statutory physical contact requirement to construe the statute in a way that substitutes employee location for customer location.
To reach that conclusion, would we have to conclude that the term contacts is ambiguous?
The city's argument starts and requires as an element this notion that contact is ambiguous. Our position is that the term contact is not ambiguous at all. And as we cited a number of dictionary definitions, it's a broad term that can covers all different types of contacts and, in fact, is intentionally broad by that way. The only definition that the city cites in order to assert an ambiguity is an element of joinder or union or joinder of a body surface. And ironically, they don't even attempt to apply that definition in their physical contact requirement. They're not saying there needs to be a physical joinder of body surfaces for there to be a business contact. But the city's argument rises and falls on ambiguity as one element. There are other defects in their argument beyond the lack of ambiguity. So cities do not have inherent taxing authority. Rather, as creatures of the state, their taxing authority is granted by statute. While the legislature has authorized cities to impose local B&O taxes, it's expressly conditioned that grant on city compliance with certain statutory requirements. Relevant here is the requirement in RCW 35.102.130 that city taxable income of multi-state service businesses, such as Wedbush, must be determined by a two-factor apportionment formula. In that formula, the average of two factors, a payroll factor and a sales factor, are multiplied by total income to determine the portion of income taxable by the city. So, for example, if a company's payroll is 3% of it is in the city and 1% of the company's sales are to customers located in the city, then you take the average of those two percentages. 3% plus 1% is 4. You divide that by 2. So 2% of their total company-wide income is in the city. There's not an argument about what the total income is, what the payroll factor is. The only issue here is about how you calculate that sales factor, specifically what number you put in the numerator of that formula.
Didn't the hearing examiner conclude that Wedbush had put in no evidence about this apportionment? In other words, what part came in the city, what part was out of the city?
No, what the hearing examiner indicated, I think the issue about evidence had to do with the determination of this cost apportionment, but there's no factual dispute about what the consequence is in terms of the tax liability, in terms of whether you use Wedbush's construction of the statute or the city's construction of the statute. The dollar impact of the legal issue is not in dispute. Those numbers are in the record, and nobody has argued that those numbers are incorrect.
So it's a pure legal issue.
It's a pure legal issue, and both the city and Wedbush have recognized this as a pure legal issue throughout. And so the issue is, does customer location mean where the customer is, or does it mean where the employee is? Under the city's example, if we have a Seattle investor who calls their broker to place an order, the city, by imposing that physical contact requirement, is saying that customer has no customer location, so we're going to look to where the broker is. But the customer location is where that where the customer is when they make the call, regardless of where the broker is. It doesn't matter whether the broker is in a Seattle office or LA office or a New York office. The Seattle customer is still a Seattle customer.
If a Seattle customer called the San Francisco office, would Seattle count that as a customer for purposes of the tax calculation?
That's correct. And the city would be, is looking to where the broker is.
Well, that's why.
You're right. So in your example, if you called somebody in San Francisco, Seattle treats that as not Seattle income. The Wedbush treats that as Seattle income. That's the difference between their two positions.
Wedbush wouldn't either because the person's in Shoreline. They're outside the city limits of Seattle. So I understand that Wedbush requires that the customer be within the city of Seattle, meaning the defined city limits.
I apologize. I didn't realize you said Shoreline. I had assumed Seattle.
Liberally says Shoreline because I'm going to get to my next question.
Oh, okay.
Does Wedbush have an office in Seattle so the Shoreline person would have a local office to call?
A sale to somebody in Shoreline would not be subject to the service income factor in Seattle. Seattle's taxing authority is limited to its geographic boundaries, and the purpose of the apportionment formula is to allocate revenue to Seattle.
Could put its office in Edmonds, when I understand there may be no B&O tax, could put its office in Seattle. Or it could have its customers call San Francisco. It makes a business decision for business reasons to have an office in Seattle.
And it has more than 90 offices throughout the United States. This isn't a question of whether the commission income from a particular trade is taxable. This is a question of how do we figure out what percentage of the total income.
I get that. And Wedbush has 95 offices and not 3 offices. And it's because it has competitors, and it wants to be seen as having a presence in the community where the customer
absolutely and that is addressed both by the payroll factor, which looks to where those employees are, as well as it gets customers from those locations by having location. So that, as a statutory matter,
you probably want to stop.
Thank you.
You're going to use
we'll
up some of your time.
Good morning. My name is Jennifer Gilman, and I represent the City of Seattle. Ms. Ginny Yee is also here. She was the auditor in this case. I've promised her she won't have to answer any questions. I want first to address a couple of the questions from the taxpayer's argument. The outcome of this case does not hinge on whether this court finds that the word contact is ambiguous. It absolutely does not. It's our position that the word contact is capable of more than one interpretation, and that is the working definition of ambiguity. However, the plain language of customer location can be used to determine whether the city's interpretation is correct. My location right now is at the Court of Appeals. This is not my address. Location is not address. The statute does not require that the only taxable instances occur from people who happen to have a Seattle address. Second, I do want to clarify that, in fact, Wedbush has never provided any evidence of where their customers have been located.
The hearing examiner make a finding of 20% in the city? I thought that was in the findings of the hearing examiner. And so I figured that was somewhere in the record.
Well, 20% of their overall, I think, for each year, their income, I think she addressed what their income was each year. For instance, in 2009, their total income was about $200,000 and their Seattle income was about $200 million and their Seattle income was about $7 million.
Let's go back to Judge Leach's example. So if I live in Shoreline, call the Wedbush Seattle office to make a trade. What is the customer location?
We don't know. I don't know where, if you call from your home in Shoreline.
Let's say it's my home in Shoreline.
If you're calling from your home in Shoreline, then presumably that's your location as well. But that's the problem with this argument, is that the taxpayer keeps saying the location is where that customer makes that call. Well, even if we could accept a phone call as an appropriate contact, even if we were to go way out on a limb and do what no other B&O city does and say that creates nexus, and I think taxpayers everywhere would be pretty upset about that, even if we were to say that, it's not as if Wedbush has ever come forward with any evidence of the location of those customers when they made those calls. So as you can see, that's not an inquiry that's very relevant to taxability. It simply isn't. I might have a Seattle address and want to make a trade and be online in a hotel room in Palm Springs.
What if I live in Seattle, but my broker transferred to the San Francisco office, and I really trust that person's judgment, so I don't deal with the Seattle office anymore. I happen to live in Seattle, but none of my business really takes place in Seattle. It all takes place in San Francisco.
And you're the customer. You're buying stock and trading. Wedbush would say that the city of Seattle should tax every piece of income that the San Francisco office generates from your business. We can't do that. We don't have any nexus with that San Francisco office. We have never said that a simple phone call from a Seattle resident making a phone call to a business that's outside the city cannot create taxability inside the city. Well, that's unconstitutional.
Okay, let's say Wedbush loses this case and Wedbush sets up a telephone system where you call a Seattle number and the call is automatically forwarded to an office outside the state of Washington. And all of the information is taken by somebody there. Does that effectively avoid the B&O tax?
Well, if the Seattle office no longer generated any income, yes, indeed it would.
Okay, now let me take it one step further. The phone call gets transmitted to an automatic telephone transcription computer program. So you get a phone call turned into an email in San Francisco, and then that email gets sent back to Seattle. So the communication is from the customer goes to Wedbush in San Francisco, and then Wedbush, San Francisco office, communicates an email to Seattle.
If Seattle performs work that generates income, gross receipts, from that trade, then yes, and more of the income from the Seattle, if we still would have to do a proportionality analysis to determine how much money does the Seattle office make, and what percentage of the work required to generate that income happened in Seattle. If none of it happened in Seattle, then it would not be taxable.
Okay, let's take it one step further. It turns out that Seattle's got a really good set of computers. So all of the trading takes place in the Seattle office, but all of the sales go from customers in the other 49 states to the other 94 offices, and there is just a transmission of information to the computer operator in Seattle to implement the trade. How do you determine the tax?
Well, I don't know. If there's actually no work being done other than on servers in the city of Seattle or computers, I believe the city's position has been that's just not enough to create nexus. We don't
that
tax.
That takes me to my next question. How do you determine how much work is done in the Seattle office? It looks to me like you're just looking at the dollar volume of profits. There isn't really any measure of what physically is getting done where.
Well, the statute requires that in order to determine income, and in order to determine the place of performance, you must look at costs of performance. And so we do that because that's the evidence that Wedbush provides. They've never provided anything else to us, and that's the standard practice for determining costs of performance. So on their detail of expenses, we see that, or I'm sorry, on their income apportionment worksheet, we see that their expenses were Their expenses were about $4 to $5 million for every year in which this audit took place.
So
Assuming that all the expenses relate to the sales that take place at the Seattle office?
Yes, because they've never contradicted that or provided any evidence otherwise. And in fact, on their detail of expenses, they do list about an $800,000 expense from the Seattle office called an incentive allocation. And that's for every year from 2010 to 2012. That incentive allocation, they've explained as that it pays for expenses incurred, what Seattle pays to the other offices, and that $800,000 covers the other activities that are helping to generate the income for the Seattle office.
I'd like to ask you a question about something else. In your briefing, you allege that the city's method of dealing with this is entitled to deference because you're an agency that's applying a statute. Let's say that the city of Edmonds did have a B&O tax, and in Edmonds, they applied in this exact same situation, the circumstances exactly as Wedbush wants it to be done. Would Edmonds also be entitled to deference?
I think they would claim to.
Well, would they be?
No.
Why would they not be? Because they're smaller? Because they're in Snohomish County?
No.
Because they're not Seattle? Why would they not be entitled to deference? You're both two cities who are applying a state statute, right?
Yes, I can tell
you that. Isn't the answer that the only agency who's entitled to deference when you're applying a state tax statute is the Department of Revenue? Because it applies it statewide. And you can't have all of these smaller governments, local governments, applying things in different ways, each claiming that they're entitled to deference.
Well,
so you're not really entitled to deference, are you? Because you're not the Department of Revenue.
Well, in this case, no one else has ever applied it differently. All 39 B&O cities do this.
That's
exactly
not the question.
Same way.
I'm not asking really about whether they apply it differently. I'm challenging your assertion that you're entitled to deference because that doesn't make sense to me. If this was an act of the Seattle City Council that only applied to employees of the city, you would have a very good argument. But this isn't that. This is a state statute that applies statewide, and the only agency that applies tax statute statewide is the Department of Revenue. So it's the only one that's entitled to deference, right?
I see what you're saying, and that is correct. We do have, it's not even an analogous provision, it's an identical provision that was passed by the Seattle City Council to track every word of the statute.
Yeah, but the problem is you're dealing with a delegated authority when you do that. You don't have an independent authority other than the state allowance that allows you to do a B&O tax.
I understand.
All
right.
Thank you.
There are no further questions.
But your time's elapsed.
Thank you.
I'd like to address a...
Do you agree that the city is not entitled to deference?
I do, absolutely. So the as Your Honor indicated, they're not the agency administering the regulatory subject of the statute.
And absent the state statute, cities cannot impose a B&O tax.
That is correct.
That was the huge argument 15 years ago or something, right, when all of this this reform happened.
And that's what led to the statute that imposed these limitations.
Yeah,
that's
to get away from the stuff I'm just talking about.
So if that's true, what is the standard of review here for us?
This is a de novo standard. This is pure de novo. It's a pure statutory construction question. What does the statute mean when it says you assign revenue to based on customer location? This court decides that issue de novo.
And what would that mean in terms of construing the phrase customer location?
Where the customer is located.
Physically located or not?
Say where the customer is located. Not where there are physical contacts between the customer and the business. So the word physical simply doesn't appear in the statute. I did want to address these.
You're using customer location in an analogous sense to somebody's domicile.
An individual's domicile, if the customer is a business, the business location of the customer, that's exactly the whole concept of apportionment is to recognize that income is earned from a variety of different activities, and we can't track exactly what portion of Wedbush's activities generated a particular commission. You know, you make a trade and there's a $100 commission.
Isn't that the city's point? Because what if the customer location is a P.O. box in the city of Seattle, but they're physically domiciled in the city of Shoreline?
But the concept behind apportionment is rather than trying to track that specifically on an individual transaction by transaction basis, you do it formulaically. And you look at different criteria that help generate that. You look at payroll. Where are people located that do activities? So in the example, if you've got the broker is in Seattle, it doesn't matter the mechanism by which the call gets routed. That's not going to change the apportionment formula in a number of those hypotheticals.
It's not going to change that element.
It's not going to change that element.
The other element.
Well, no, the only two elements that get picked up in this formula is where the customer is located and where the employees are located. And you look at those two things and you blend them together and then you say, and you basically, as a formulary matter, that gives us a rough approximation of how much Seattle contributes to the overall company-wide income. So we apply that percentage. The more customers that are domiciled or otherwise located in Seattle, the bigger that number is, the more people they put there. Whether it's the trading desk or any other piece, that's all going to affect how much goes to Seattle. As a matter of statutory construction, there is no physical contact requirement. We ask that the trial court be reversed.
Thank you. And Ruffin in Seattle is next.